Welcome, listeners, wherever you are. You're listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio 95.9 FM. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, today we have a double feature for you from fall 2017 about magic and murder in the desert. Our first episode today was produced by Ken Lane on September 15th, 2017. The title is Jack Parsons and the Babylon Working. Enjoy.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the American desert, and that means it is time for Desert Oracle Radio, and it's a much cooler night than we have been able to recently enjoy. Summer is almost gone. You can leave the windows open at night again without waking up crying. That's always nice. And at the Goldstone Deep Space Antenna Station, located in a lonesome and quiet bowl in the mountains, midway between Barstow and Badwater, there is some sadness tonight, but there's also pride and joy because one of the greatest space science missions in our brief history of exploring the solar system came to an end on this very morning. At 4:55 a.m. Mojave time, that's when contact was lost with the Cassini spacecraft as it plunged as planned into the churning atmosphere of Saturn. Goldstone is one of three deep space antenna stations spread around our planet, placed 120 degrees apart. As the world turns, the signal from Cassini passed over from one antenna station to the next, set in quiet open space here in the California desert and west of Madrid and southwest of the Australian capital, Canberra. These isolated antenna complexes take in a steady stream of transmissions from our far-flung robotic correspondents, including the Voyager probes, the Mars Express, the Mars Odyssey. And until this morning, Cassini, ending a mission that began 20 years ago with its launch back in 1997. Cassini reached Saturn in 2004 and spent 9 years in close company with the ringed planet and its many strange moons, moons with plumes of water and snow, and lakes of liquid methane. There may well be life on these moons, especially in the water seas beneath the rocky crust. And to protect these biospheres, Cassini was deliberately piloted into Saturn itself, burning up so that it would not infect these mysterious moons. The final signal was not heard at Goldstone, which was turning toward the sun with the rest of the California desert by then, but at NASA's Deep Space Network antenna complex in Canberra, which was facing mighty Saturn when Cassini was the subject of assisted suicide. It was a grand mission by NASA, the European Space Agency, the Italian Space Agency, and of course the Jet Propulsion Lab at Caltech in Pasadena. An interesting thing about Cassini, the famed astronomer, born in Genoa in 1625, is that his first field of study was not astronomy, but astrology. Love of one led to the other. We are rarely reminded that many of the most storied names in science and invention, Isaac Newton, John Dee, Roger Bacon, Alexander Graham Bell, Thomas Edison, and of course Jack Parsons, the occultist and founder of the Jet Propulsion Lab, were alchemists and magicians. Jack Parsons grew up in Pasadena with a wild and questing mind. He was building small rockets as a child, and he would become one of the crucial innovators of rocketry. But his interest in and practice of ritual magic led to his ouster at JPL and Aerojet, which were his creations more than anyone else. And in 1945, he found himself free to perform his magical rituals full-time. His frequent partner was none other than L. Ron Hubbard, who had his own career cut short in the U.S. Navy and shared Parsons' interest in science fiction and sorcery. For reasons still in dispute today and with results that are difficult to prove but do make an interesting argument for themselves, Parsons and Hubbard began a long ritual they called the Babylon Working. It is beyond the scope of a family program on the radio to go into great detail here, but the important part is this. The ritual was reportedly completed in the Mojave Desert on January the 18th, 1946, a completion that would be verified by the appearance of the entity Parsons and Hubbard called the Scarlet Woman. When they returned to Pasadena, she was there waiting, in the form of the artist and muse, Marjorie Cameron. I returned home, Parsons later wrote, and found a young woman answering the requirements, waiting for me. While she enjoyed the bohemian scene at Parsons' Pasadena Magical Lodge on Orange Grove Avenue, but she was not originally aware that she had apparently been summoned by ritual magic. Only when she reported her sighting of a luminous disc, possibly the first sighting of the modern flying saucer era, did Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard let her in on their secret. They had opened a hole in the sky, a hole in space and time, and something, or many things, had come through it. Jack Parsons died in 1952, allegedly from an explosion in his home laboratory. By the end, he had been betrayed and abandoned by both his rocketry peers and his magical lodge. Now, L. Ron Hubbard found success as a science fiction writer and eventually as a prophet with his own religion. And Marjorie Cameron lived a long life as an artist and underground muse of the occult scene in Los Angeles. Instead of building spaceships, by the end of his life, Jack Parsons, an expert chemist and inspired alchemist, was making explosives for Hollywood movies. But NASA and JPL and human spaceflight and even the Cassini mission to Saturn do not exist on our timeline without the rocketry genius of Marvel Whitehead Parsons, the pioneer we know as Jack Parsons. Speaking of Marvel, his given name, if you look at his photographs today, especially the famous shot taken in 1941, this dashing, goateed rocketry and chemistry pioneer may well remind you of the Marvel Comics character Tony Stark. The broken-hearted businessman, chemist, and rocketry pioneer who becomes the Iron Man, as drawn by the legendary Jack Kirby, who had his own direct connection to the great old gods of space and time. And Jack Parsons will surely bring to mind the Tony Stark as portrayed by the actor Robert Downey Jr. And those scenes of Afghanistan in 2008's Iron Man movie, they were filmed in the Alabama hills, just off the 395 in the eastern Sierra Desert, the setting for hundreds of movies and television shows about cowboys and superheroes and space monsters. There's a movie history museum right there in Lone Pine. I encourage you to visit. Another place you can visit, one of the eeriest places you can visit today, is a place called Rocket Sight Road, which crosses the old 20 Mule Team Road south of Boron at the far end of Edwards Air Force Base, just west of Kramer Junction on the 395. There is a jagged, burnt-up mountain here, clearly visible from the public roadway, and it is studded with the metal hulks of old rocket engines tested by NASA and JPL and the military. The engines bolted to the rock so they wouldn't hurl themselves across the sky. And there was a mysterious explosion at the Rocket Site Laboratory on September 7th of 1990. A mushroom cloud rose over the lab as lines of ambulances raced down Rocket Site Road. People who live along Highway 58 there were not told that the toxic cloud was hydrogen chloride from a multi-rocket and missile explosion. The poison cloud dispersed over the western Mojave. Now, Jack Parsons performed ancient and new magic rituals. Rituals of blood and skin and desert wind. He writes of the completion of this working in the Mojave Desert. In January 1946, I had been engaged in the study and practice of magic for 7 years, and in the supervision and operation of an occult lodge for 4 years, having been initiated into the Sanctuary of the Gnosis by the Beast 666, Brother 132, and Brother Saturnus. At this time, I decided upon a magical operation designed to obtain the assistance of an elemental mate. This is a well-known procedure in magic, consisting of the invocation of a spirit or elemental into tangible existence by various magical techniques. Jack Parsons says that the completion of this ritual was met with a massive windstorm across the desert. Once he returned home, there were electrical problems. The lights failed one night. Another magician staying in the lodge was struck in the shoulder by an unseen presence. Candles knocked out of people's hands. And several people in the Pasadena Lodge observed a brownish yellow light floating about 7 feet high in their kitchen. Says Jack Parsons, "I banished it with a magical sword and it disappeared." Along the northeastern boundary of the Tohono O'odham Nation in south-central Arizona, there are curious structures said to be home to demons and late-night rituals. These structures are not part of the reservation. They are relatively modern on private land, in fact, having only been constructed in the early 1980s. In the upcoming autumn issue of Desert Oracle, you will find an interesting story of these domes by Jason Woodbury, long a resident of nearby Coolidge. We spoke to Jason, a talented music critic and well-known music and records man of Phoenix, Arizona, about his investigation of these strange space-age structures.
They're off Interstate 8, south of Casa Grande. You can actually see them from the highway. You get off on Thornton Road and you go south, and it turns to a dirt road right before you hit these domes, these structures that were erected in the early 80s. They feel older, they look more fantastical, you know, than, oh, these were some things built in the early 80s by a technologies company to build microchips out in the desert, which is what is established. They are that. That's what it was. They were built in 1982 by a company called Intercom Technologies to build microchips, probably provide jobs for Casa Grande residents and, you know, semi-skilled labor and all that stuff. So, but they were abandoned pretty quickly on. They never actually went into operation. From the road, you can kind of see them off in the distance. You see the very tops of them, because there's, you know, brush everywhere up around. There's trees and stuff surrounding them. And then you turn off of the interstate. You go down this road. There's a couple trailer homes. Nothing much out there. You know, it's fairly removed from Casa Grande proper. And you see them on your left side, clear as day. They're these weird-looking domes. They look like something out of Star Wars. They look like Tatooine settlements or something like that. There is a barbed wire fence surrounding them. They are private property. You can just climb right through that barbed wire fence. It's very easy to do. And a lot of people have done it, apparently, because they're tagged up, you know, just covered in graffiti. But they're weird. They're weird looking, and there's a weird energy to the place. And when I walked through it, I actually took out my iPhone and I recorded me stepping through them, because there's a weird ricochet pattern from your feet on the concrete, and it kind of bounces around in these dome structures. And they're a very strange place that, for a lot of reasons, took on like an air of local mystery. Local lore sprang up around the domes. So I grew up in Coolidge, which is a neighboring town, and it's close enough, you know. And you'd hear just random bizarre tales, lots of tales about satanic rituals. I think that we're talking, you know, the domes were fairly well abandoned even by the mid 80s, so that's ripe for the satanic panic kind of movement, where every space that wasn't completely sanitized or safe to be sort of took on this weird air of evil energies or whatever. So there was definitely a lot of stuff like that. People would talk about how there were sacrifices out there. People would talk about how they were haunted. People would talk about how there were specifically demons creeping around the domes. And some of the graffiti plays into that. It's probably hard to say what's the cause and what's the effect. If somebody spray painted a pentagram on there and then all of a sudden people started to get very, you know, spooky ideas about what the place was. Or if those stories started spreading and someone showed up and thought, a place this evil deserves a good pentagram. You know, I don't know which one it was. It says 666 on one of the domes. Somebody spray painted that. And there are all these rumors of people going out there to sacrifice chickens or sacrifice other animals. And I saw no such evidence of bloodshed on my trip out there. But nonetheless, I mean, it just kind of circulates. You know, everybody talked about these places, these domes, as if there was a certain paranormal energy out there. And the otherworldly vibe of the place and the way these things look, which people will be able to see some photos in the magazine, but they do look like flying saucers landed in the desert. One of them has got like the traditional flying saucer shape, and the others are more rounded. Local lore just sprang up around people going out there to party, and they'd show up and there were people in cloaks there, or people went out there to drink a 40 and there was a bunch of dead birds. All these things, people just talk about these things. And I don't know anybody who, and nobody apparently took photos. Nobody documented it. Apparently the cops would get called out there all the time, probably by residents of the mobile homes that are nearby, because kids are out there partying. You know what I mean? That's what I think, that's what I know happened out there, was kids went out there and drank beers and just hung out. And that was a really easy, there was something about growing up in a place like Coolidge or like Casa Grande, Pinal County, there were all these abandoned spaces around the cities that took on this same kind of lore. I don't think I ever went out to the domes as a high schooler to do anything too illicit, but there were other spaces like that. There was the coffin factory outside of Coolidge, or the bomb factory, which is what, and these are just things people called it. I always assumed that none of these things were what people had said they were, but it turns out the bomb factory, which was this space kind of out on the Gila River Indian Reservation, that we could drive to taking back roads out of Coolidge, it turns out it was a real munitions factory. So sometimes maybe there was some shred of truth at the heart of these sort of abandoned ruins that continued and people built upon or used to further their own lore about them. For the most part, I always found these places striking because they took on an air of mystery just by virtue of their weirdness, by virtue of their sort of being abandoned structures.
Is there a local monster associated with any of these places that has a name or a...
I don't know that there was a local monster associated so much with the domes, but I definitely remember that as far as these spaces around Coolidge, people talked about Hoofman, who was a man with cloven hooves. This was it, like you'd hear about the Hoofman at the munitions factory or at the coffin factory, or just sort of out, often associated with the spaces around town. So the reservation for the most part. And I had Native American friends who would tell me stories about Hoofman, who was a man with cloven hooves, and how, you know, you'd hear stories about how a man had gone into the casino and had won big, you know, kind of walking from slot machine to slot machine, winning big, and then he would leave, and then upon collecting his winnings and departing, people would rewatch the footage, and you would notice that he had cloven hooves in his in the video footage. You never noticed it when you were talking to him. So Hoofman was definitely talked about a lot. We had the Weeping Woman was a big one too, around the canals. I think that's a pretty common one any place where you have, you know, Chicano culture or Hispanic culture, but like a woman who had drowned her babies for some reason in her youth, and now she patrols the canals, you know, crying out for these children. That was a really popular one around town. And you'd hear that because you'd have to cross over the canal to get out to these spaces. So talk would turn to La Rona, is what they'd call her, you know. It wouldn't be hard to scrounge up somebody who would tell you that on their way out to the coffin factory, they saw her even this very evening, you know what I mean? So there have been schemes to keep them standing, you know, and that's the thing that's probably what probably signals their doom even more so than the fact that they are maybe structurally deficient. The biggest dome has collapsed, so you can kind of see out onto the mountains facing the I-10 from this dome, you know. So there's been just actual decay, and probably the vandalism has contributed to their kind of structural deficiency. But I think what probably assures their doom more than anything is the fact that nobody knows what to do with them. There is nothing to do with them. The owners have talked about selling them. Due to their unusual circumstance, they are worth some money, you know? There's something of value to them. The city declared in 2017, they declared that they needed to be torn down because they're a public hazard. The owner, Daniel Peer, has appealed to the city to try to keep them up, but I think what really ultimately dooms them is that nobody has any idea really what use they could provide or what they could be used for. They would probably require substantial repair to be used for anything official or in any official capacity. Eventually they'll be torn down because nobody else knows what to do with them. I tend to think that these things have an artistic value. And maybe that comes from being a kid who was raised in Pinal County, where we didn't have, I mean, you know, there was a library, obviously, and there was maybe like a city hall with maybe some sort of monuments or some sort of historical record. But really, these things strike me as being their own form of outsider art, you know? And I sort of feel like they should be venerated as an example of what happens when there's people around who for whatever reason, assign value to a thing. And the kind of value that's assigned is mostly curiosity. It's mostly local mythology. But people feel strongly about them. I mean, when I posted on my Facebook page they were going to be torn down, people were bummed out. You know, they're like, no, they can't tear them down. Nobody has a good idea what you should do with them, but people do care about them. They symbolize something. I think they symbolize a certain kind of weirdness that takes root in desert communities, a certain kind of outsider quality that just really feels, it feels magical because we decided that it's magical. They are valuable to us because they're there and because they're weird. My name's Jason P. Woodbury. I'm a pop culture writer and music journalist. I write for Aquarium Drunkard and co-host the Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions podcast, and I come from Phoenix, Arizona.
Some announcements. Well, this is a big one, and I do hope you will mark your calendar. November 16 at 6 p.m. on Free Museum Thursday at the Sublime Palm Springs Art Museum, we will be presenting Desert Oracle Radio live in the lecture hall. This is the first time we are attempting such a feat, and by we, I mean not only your Desert Oracle host, but also Doc Daniels of Mojave Phone Booth Infamy, and Brendan Mays, who you know from his frequent baffling phone calls to this program, and other special surprises. Make a night of it. Enjoy downtown Palm Springs at the very nicest time of year, a cool autumn evening. And we, meaning I, will present Desert Oracle Campfire Stories in person at the Ace Hotel and Swim Club in Palm Springs on Thursday, October 5th, 7 p.m. at the Commune Fire Ring, free and open to all, again on Thursday, November 2nd, and again on Wednesday night, December 13th, all at 7 p.m. As for me, I will appreciate every blessed day and night from now through the perfect season of fall, the cold and sunny desert winter, the wondrous spring, for this is the good time of year in the high desert, the best time of year. This program is brought to you by Desert Oracle, the pocket-sized quarterly journal of the American Desert. Become a subscriber today, and I will mail you four delightful issues. Send $25 by check or money order to Desert Oracle, P.O. Box 1735, Joshua Tree, California, or subscribe online at desertoracle.com. Get the podcast of this broadcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and tune in the radio app that turns your $1,000 cell phone into a somewhat reliable $10 radio. I do enjoy your letters and tweets and other forms of communication. I encourage you to drop us a line, radio@desertoracle.com. Have an idea for the show? Would you like to be on the show? We are open for suggestions. Desert Oracle Radio can be heard on KCDZ 107.7 FM Fridays. 10 p.m. is the promised time, but your listening flexibility is appreciated. Heard from Amboy to Zizex and across the Great Mojave Wilderness. And good night from the voice of the desert.
Our second episode is titled From Missing Hikers to Murder-Suicide. It was produced by Ken Lane, October 27, 2017. For those sensitive to such topics, as the title implies, this episode briefly mentions a murder-suicide.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the American desert. We come to you from Joshua Tree, miles of scattered mobile homes, auto graveyards, and strange scenes behind the Circle K, gateway community to Joshua Tree National Park, where tourists disappear. The Mojave Desert has again claimed the lives of hikers, sort of. You'll recall that back in late July, that hellish July in the middle of the hottest California summer in history, two Orange County visitors vanished after a simple day hike near their Airbnb in South Joshua Tree. Rachel Nguyen, age 20, and her ex-boyfriend, Joseph Orbeso, 21, were found dead in the national park on October 15, months after their July 28th disappearance, both killed by Orbeso's handgun. He was a security guard. That was his work. His friends told the paper in Orange County that he was a survivalist, that he always carried knives. He scoped out the high desert a week before he brought his ex-girlfriend there for her birthday. They were in the part of the park that borders the town of Joshua Tree, the Panorama Heights neighborhood. It's a nice place. You see people walking their dogs and riding their bicycles around there every day, usually in the cooler morning or evening in the summertime. This guy brought a loaded handgun. The couple was found in an embrace, with their shorts pulled down, according to the sheriff's department. I wonder who did the embracing. Probably the ex-boyfriend who murdered his ex-girlfriend in the desert, considering that he killed her first before turning the gun on himself. The local sheriff's department said this to the press. There is no indication that he wanted to harm her, that there was any plan for something like this. Well, that's the dumbest damn thing I've ever heard, and I used to cover the police beat full time. He was her ex-boyfriend. The ex-boyfriend of a beautiful girl who was likely going somewhere in life. Somewhere that probably did not include a security guard and knife fanatic and gun nut. He got put in the friend zone. He scoped out Joshua Tree the week before by public transportation, which is the guaranteed way to be invisible in a place like the high desert. He said, "Let's go take a day hike in the nice national park by our Airbnb." They got high. He brought a loaded handgun. Normal day out. And once they were on the north end of the Maze Trail, which seems like you're in a very remote location until you see the community college and the highway traffic down the hill, well, then he shot her dead. Crawled on top of her and shot himself. No harm intended. Just another day hike gone wrong. This county is something else. The whole economy is driven by tourists coming to the wild desert, the national parks, and the national monuments, and the absolute last thing the sheriff's department understands or cares about is the desert that is the entire driver of the economy. Both the killer and the victim were tourists. Tourists in the national park. If I ran the Department of the Interior instead of the current sleazebag zooming around by private jet to give your public lands to his dear friends at the oil and gas companies, crimes inside a national park or monument or wilderness would be exclusively the domain of a National Park Investigative Service. It would explore not only murders, but all crimes involving the complex ecosystems and climates of these parks and protected lands. They would be the top investigative force in all the wild places, skilled in the comprehension and investigation of crimes of the physical and metaphysical realms. Expert investigators of the paranormal, trained clergy and accredited scientists. Astronomers, biologists, masters of criminal intent and analysis. Expert marksmen, true survivalists, intent on the survival of the Earth and its species, including but not limited to humanity. why they can solve a crime before they ever find the bodies, although they will find the bodies and find them quick. They can reunite a lost dog with its family and stop traffic on Park Boulevard so the bighorn can safely cross over to Barker Dan in the morning. They can shoot an illegal drone out of the sky at 1,000 meters and then write a citation for the bozos who thought a whining, buzzing piece of flying garbage from Amazon is the kind of thing you bring to America's national parks. They can administer last rites for every major religion and provide philosophical and theological solace to the survivors. A warrior monk society of the finest and highest moral fiber. Are you sitting around waiting for a mission in life, feeling helpless as you're tossed and turned by events, helplessly reacting to the deeds of the evildoers instead of taking action to put our civilization back on course? Well, then you might have what it takes to join us. Join us in this great mission to restore morality and human decency to our sickly species, to drive the evil ones and the vile opportunists from the agora, the public realm. To aid the rapid transmutation and transformation of our world from a fossil fuel dependent, weather wrecking nightmare of never ending burning summer and fire and destruction and pain and boredom. Join us in the salvation of our home planet and the salvation of humanity. We'll get those sleaze bags yet, and we'll put them in the pit of despair. If you'd like to inquire about this mission or the film rights, drop us a line, radio@desertoracle.com. The 20th century telephone booth is an iconic place of mythological memory. In the great cities where the telephone booth first appeared, they were first a symbol of public security and the urban jungle. First in Albany, New York in 1877, next in Chicago and London, secure booths to contact the police, the fire department, the ambulance service. In Chicago, the first boxes were limited to use by police with keys, but there were switches that anyone could activate to alert the authorities to various emergencies, forgery and theft, accidents and fires, drunkards and murderers. The public payphone within a tiny building, the original tiny house, was a common sight in cities around the world by the early 20th century. And now came a second purpose and identity, a momentarily private and anonymous space within the teeming hordes of urban humanity. The telephone booth was the office of the pimp and the prostitute, the neighborhood bookie and the corner drug dealer. It was the time-traveling home of Doctor Who and the changing room where mild-mannered Clark Kent stripped off his gray business suit to reveal the Superman. In the days before the mobile phone was common, you might see a correspondent struggling to force a pair of rubber attachments over the greasy phone headset in order to slowly transmit a news update from an old, Tandy computer. In a desolate place outside a lonely gas station on a dark and lonesome desert road, that electric light within a glass-windowed box provided a weird mix of security and exposure. From the outside, a phone booth beckons you with the promise of safety from whatever's out there, whatever's after you. From within, that fluorescent tube of sickly white light reflecting on the grimy, scratched-up glass and the filthy public telephone could fill you with dread. Because now you could not see anything out there. Now you're trapped. As the phone booths disappeared from America in the 1990s, first replaced with useless enclosures that enclosed neither the phone nor the human user, and eventually removed altogether as the long-distance profits vanished with the arrival of cell phone national calling plans. The phone booth began to mean something else, like mailboxes and normal park benches, reminders of a lost society that wasn't 100% at war with our humanity. As the bad people took an ever-increasing share of the nation's wealth, as millions of people faced the monthly possibility of losing their shelter, as libraries were shuttered and you eventually could not even hail a cab without a $100 a month cell phone and a credit card, the phone booth became romantic and nostalgic in that sad way that eats at your soul. The new world may turn out to be good after all. The earthly paradise may yet be recovered and made anew, but it will be a long, unpleasant slog through the current dystopia. I first learned of an Arizona character called the Deuce of Clubs in the year or so before the turn of the century when I found his charmingly insane website, deuceofclubs.com. Of the many pursuits explored in this strange collection of web pages, the biggest draw for me was this person's love affair with a phone booth in one of my favorite places on the planet, the wild and open lands within Mojave National Preserve. This same character, now passing himself off as Duck Daniels, has written many of your favorite pieces within the pages of Desert Oracle, the pocket-sized field guide to the mysterious American desert. Doc Daniels joins us now by telephone from his desert hideout in Arizona.
Spontaneous planning conversation. Well, it's more spontaneous than planned because I don't really know what we're doing here, but... And I'm walking the dog while I'm using one crutch.
You're on a crutch.
Yes.
I'm sorry to bother you in this time of personal trouble, and also on your your dog walk. What you're on a crutch?
I am on a crutch. So I have a phone, and I have a crutch, and I have a dog.
What kind of weather are you having on this nice, cool fall evening?
Beautiful. It's about 73 degrees. Nice, cool. We got the moon up in the sky. It's gorgeous.
You are going to be taking part in our November 16th Desert Oracle Radio Live event at the Ace Hotel in Palm Springs, and you are bringing a Mojave phone booth, but as I understand it, it's not the Mojave phone booth. Please explain.
You have expressed it correctly, sir. The Mojave phone booth, unfortunately, was taken to an undisclosed location and destroyed by the government. This phone booth is a prop phone booth that was used in a movie called Mojave Phone Booth. And it's very cleverly constructed. It holds together, comes apart and goes together real easily because it's constructed with door hinges, just regular door hinges.
Common door hinges for a feature film.
Common door hinges.
This is movie magic.
An independent film.
A portable phone booth.
It's a portable phone booth. You never know where it might pop up.
You don't see a Mojave phone booth inside a entertainment hall and a hotel every day.
Not every day. In fact, not to my knowledge ever. But it will be on the 16th of November.
I hear that you were putting together a book about your experiences with the Mojave phone booth.
It is true. It is called Adventures with the Mojave Phone Booth. I've been putting it together for way too long. It's about to happen.
I'm waiting out a little bit of static here.
It's pretty appropriate because when you were on the actual Mojave phone booth, the line was always crackling with weird types of static. The book actually is finished. I'm just doing logistical work now, trying to get the thing printed out.
Where can the audience find more information about this book? Adventures with the Mojave Phone Booth. by Doc Daniels.
They can go to MojaveFoneBoothBook.com. That's probably the best way to do it.
It is a romantic and comic tale of adventure and discovery and other such things. How would you explain the book in a sentence or two?
Well, I remember there was a summation of it that I thought was pretty good when it first started happening. It was something like, boy meets phone, boy loves phone, phone is destroyed by government.
We are long overdue for a Desert Oracle radio mailbag. Shannon Brown writes, Mr. Lane, I spent many nights camping in the desert on the perimeter of Edwards Air Force Base as a kid, and still have strong recollections of those eerie howls, those unexplained lights, and the late night hikes that led to the discovery of mysterious concrete plugs embedded in the desert floor, seemingly abandoned antenna arrays, and old gunnery range remnants. Those were great days to have access to the South Track Boy Scout camp adjacent to the old rocket sled test site. The 1990 Rocket Lab accident that you mentioned was the result of a rocket motor being accidentally dropped by a crane. This was one of several incidents that afflicted the Titan IV heavy launch program, if memory serves. There was a Titan IV booster motor explosion in 1991 and a series of other mishaps that prompted Phillips Laboratory employees at the Rocket Lab site to print and distribute little blue calling cards featuring the outline of the Titan IV, the Martin Marietta Morale Booster. I've got one around here somewhere. Unrelated, but nonetheless worth a mention, is the curious story of Walking George Swain, a Boron resident who was a regular in primary and secondary school classrooms in the area. He was brought in by science teachers to talk about desert conservation, desert wildlife, and limiting one's impact on the land. I have only vague memories of his presentations, but the themes certainly struck a chord. If you haven't heard of him, there's quite a bit on the internet about his eccentric life. He strikes me as the kind of guy who'd be a good fit for a profile on the broadcast. I eagerly look forward to the next installment, and I can't wait for the next print issue. Shannon Brown. Well, Walking George was the kind of character you hope to meet in the desert, the kind of pleasant oddball you wish you had in your desert community. Maybe in exchange for a couple hundred of the regular people, the whiners and the bores. A Walking George Swain was something else altogether. The Los Angeles Daily News, in an obituary for Swain, who died at the age of 80 on April 25 of the year 2000, describes him as a man who traveled the West in search of operas and in support of environmental causes, who refused to clutter his life with a home or a car. Born in 1919 in Los Angeles, George Swain served in World War II and then had a brief education at Stanford in chemistry. And it was enough. He began work at the U.S. Borax plant in Boron on the fourth day of the fourth month of 1944. He retired in 1986 and for many years lived in a miner's cabin provided by U.S. Borax. The rest of the time, he camped in the desert. He holed up in abandoned miner's shacks in the area, and he served as a house sitter for his friends. And occasionally, he stayed at the Boron Motel. And he shaved and he showered at the mine. It was a good life, a simple life. George greatly admired John Muir and especially loved the operas of Wagner. Desert conservation was his mission in life, his true love. A talented musician, he joined the local Baptist church because he was invited to use the piano and organ there. And in time, he became the pianist and the organist at both the First Baptist Church and St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Boron. The theological differences were unimportant, as he was an atheist. You'll find in life that the most moral and decent humans do not need to practice a religion, although they generally enjoy the peace and serenity of temples and churches, and they have a deep need for the quiet beauty of wild nature. As an admirer of John Muir, George valued his membership in the John Muir Memorial Association, and he made a point of never missing the annual dinner over his 25 years of membership. He always performed classical and opera pieces when visiting the Tuolumne Meadows Lodge up Tioga Pass, and whenever he traveled by vehicle, he preferred that vehicle be a train. He was a romantic soul, and romantic souls always loved the trains. Now about the nickname he earned, Walking George, it will not surprise you to learn that George Swain was a walking man, a lifelong walker, whether across the deserts or up and down the Sierra Nevada. He'd walk to Death Valley for a weekend stroll, 100 miles. Boron's annual festival, the 20 Mule Team Days, always has a big parade, including the famous 20 Mule Team Borax wagons that once ran from Death Valley to the Western Mojave. Well, Walking George was also in that parade every year, and his parading style consisted of George Swain walking the parade route and greeting his neighbors and friends along the way. If you want to see a pair of George Swain's size 14 hiking boots, stop over at the 20 Mule Team Museum in Boron. They've got a pair of his weathered old boots on display. George Swain was a legend for much of his adult life. He was on national TV shows and he was featured in the newspapers. In a 1978 profile by the Los Angeles Times, the reporter describes George with a kind of longing, a longing for a life that few of us have considered, a life that sounds so good in theory, and yet what do we do with our time that's any better? I know I've never done anything better than walking miles of desert hills with no particular destination. But if I heard somebody playing Wagner on a piano from an empty church on a desert byway, I'd sure head in that direction, just to listen through the doorway for a bit. The musical sounds you are hearing at the moment come from an artist here in Joshua Tree who goes by the name Red Blue Black Silver, and you can hear more at redblueblacksilver.com. Our theme music is by Pierre Langer, and you can find links to the various musical backgrounds and their creators at our own website, desertoracle.com. Desert Oracle Radio is broadcast on KCDZ 107.7 FM, Fridays 10 p.m. There is nothing like listening to the program on the FM radio. It will give you chills just knowing all these other high desert people are listening to the broadcast along with you in the night. Remember to get your free reserved seating for our November 16 live program, 7 p.m. a Thursday night at the Ace Hotel, Palm Springs. We've got Jeremy Kenyon Lockyer Corbell, he of the UFO documentaries, including the new Patient 17, out now on iTunes, is a weird damn thing. You should see it. Doc Daniels of Mojave Phone Booth Infamy will be there, along with area businessman Brendan Mays and other special surprises. Eventbrite, B-R-I-T-E, misspelled like everything on the internet, or from our website, desertoracle.com, spelled correctly. For those of you coming from out of town, use Desert Oracle as your discount code for 10% off your lodging at the Ace Hotel and Swim Club. Desert Oracle Campfire Stories, our original and ongoing monthly event at the Ace Hotel, comes again on Thursday, November 2nd, next week, once again, 7 p.m. around the fire ring, free and open to all. We had a very fine time at the October 7 event, and I want to thank all of you good people for coming from all over. Landers, Yucca Valley, Oceanside, Los Angeles, Blue Diamond in Nevada, even Chicago. Around and across the Mojave, from Amboy to Zizek's, and across the great Mojave wilderness, this has been Desert Oracle Radio. If you have a good community radio station in your desert town and you want to hear our program on that station, do us a favor and let them know, let us know, and we shall endeavor to make it happen. Meanwhile, get the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and TuneIn and the rest. Thanks again for listening. And good night from the voice of the desert.
My thanks to Ken Lane for producing the episodes we heard today. And thank you everyone for listening. And I'll be back next week with more. Right here on KGBM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Stay well. See you then. Bye-bye.